Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I am your host extraordinaire, Jonathan Strickland, and with me in the studio today is, you know him, you love him, Scott Benjamin.
You love him?
Oh, they do.
Oh, really?
I get notes.
Huh.
People love when you're on the show.
That's impressive.
Yeah. Yeah, people, what, that my listeners can read and write?
No, I wasn't saying that. Oh, okay. It was just, you never know these things.
That's true. Yeah, you come on as a guest onto my show, and you are not privy to the communiques that come into the Tech Stuff world. I should let you know more frequently that people do enjoy when you're on.
Well, that's nice. I appreciate it. And I have a great time when I'm here, so I'm glad to be back. And this is a topic that I'm pretty excited about talking about today.
Yeah, I picked something that was outside of our respective wheelhouses a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Aircraft carriers and super carriers. And this was something that came about because many ages ago, when I was first making up the topic list of potential topics for Tech Stuff, one of the news items at the time was about the next generation of super carriers here in the United States, the Ford class aircraft carrier.
Yeah.
So we're going to be talking a lot about the current state of the art, which is the Nimitz class aircraft carrier. We'll talk about the next generation. We'll talk about previous generations. But to start it all off, I wanted to explain how amazing, how old this idea is. It actually predates controlled flight.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know a whole lot about this because we were digging into aircraft carriers.
Yeah.
And just kind of as a side note of some article that I was reading,
mm-hmm.
it had mentioned that in the late 19th century, they were using ships to launch manned balloons.
Right.
For reconnaissance missions and things like that.
Exactly.
So it was always about reconnaissance. It was always about monitoring the enemy.
Right. Because in the 19th century, the navies around the world were relying heavily upon battleship class dreadnoughts, these enormous ships with heavy weaponry on them that would batter one another. That was how naval battles were decided back in the
late 19th and early 20th centuries. And so much so that any idea, like any thought of using air support was mainly just to get a look around and see where the enemy was. Mm-hmm. Like that was the only purpose, right? They were not thought of as this would be a, we're going to weaponize balloons. It was more like we need eyes in the sky so that we know where the enemy might be.
Well, even during the American Civil War, they used balloons. They would float a balloon from their camp.
Yeah.
To check out what the enemy was doing, you know, on the other side of the hill.
Yeah.
And then bring it back down. But the intent was never to fire from up there or anything. It was just to keep an eye on the enemy.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the same thing is true with the earliest days of aircraft carriers in the way we think of them. Now, what surprised me was that it did not take long at all from the moment that we have controlled flight, that is a heavier than air aircraft that can fly through the control of a human being, and the first attempts at making an aircraft carrier. So I know that there is some disagreement about who was truly responsible for the first heavier than air aircraft. We're going to go with the Wright brothers for this one. And they flew at Kitty Hawk in
1903.
It took less than a decade before the United States military started saying, maybe we can launch one of these suckers from a boat.
Yeah, not a bad idea, huh?
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's always the kind of the way it goes, right? With the military, they're thinking, well, you know what? This would be a devastating machine of war.
Exactly.
How could we make this work for us?
Right.
And that's exactly what they did. They said, well, you know, let's try to figure out a way to make, well, they need a nice big takeoff and landing area.
Right.
But, well, there's no way really to do that on a boat unless we build something that's maybe made out of wood that's a huge flat deck. Let's try that.
Yeah.
And they did, and it worked.
Yeah, it was crazy. They built a temporary wooden deck on top of the USS Birmingham in 1910. This was truly just an experiment, right? It was mm-hmm. just a proof of concept. And they found a brave man, or some might say lunatic, to attempt to fly a tiny biplane, a Curtis biplane.
Yeah, 50 horsepower.
50 horsepower. A 50 horsepower biplane. Can you imagine? You're rolling down this wooden platform that's built on top of a battleship. The battleship was not meant to do this, right?
It
was, they had to shore up all this area to create a wooden structure for you to roll across, not necessarily knowing if you would be able to reach the right speed to be able to take off or if you would just plunge off the end and into the ocean.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a scary prospect. I mean, for this guy, I mean, his name is, he was actually a civilian pilot. His name was Eugene Burton Ely.
Yep.
And this is so strange the way this is written. And I'll read it the way it's written, and then I'll explain because it sounds so weird.
Right.
It says, on November 14th, 1910, a 24-year-old civilian pilot, and again, Eugene, took off in a 50-horsepower Curtis plane from the bow of the Birmingham, which is a, you know, wooden platform cruiser again, and later landed a Curtis Model D on Pennsylvania on January 18th of 1911. So those of you that were listening, well, will realize that it wasn't a 2-month flight and he didn't change planes in midair.
Right.
They just hadn't figured out the landing bit of this yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this happens like 2 months apart or three months apart, maybe.
So yeah, what happened was they did the first one, and then the second attempt, the second test took place in San Francisco Bay. That's where the Pennsylvania was anchored. And, he took off from a landing strip on land,
mm-hmm.
took off, flew out to the ship, landed on it, stayed for an hour, took off from the ship, and landed back on the mainland.
Interesting. So that's actually the first time that both of those things happened at one time.
Right.
The initial, the initial takeoff, I guess, was just a one-time deal, and they just wanted to see if they could do it. They didn't even really consider landing at this point. I'm sure they were thinking about it,
mm-hmm.
but they weren't willing to risk it yet. They needed a couple more months to develop a way to do it, or maybe to look into the stats of how long it took a Curtis Model D to stop.
To actually come to a stop, right? Because, if it's longer than the boat is, you got yourself a problem.
Yeah.
As it turns out, we would come up with ways to address that problem. Now, here's the interesting thing to me. The U.S. military was very quick to test out this idea. But they were not quick to implement it. The Navy at the time was largely of the United States Navy, I should say, was largely of the opinion that this was still the domain of the big battleships. Mm-hmm. And soon the cruisers would follow. Cruisers would be slightly smaller, slightly more maneuverable, faster ships than battleships.
And we're talking about World War One era.
Yeah.
Ships.
Yeah. Pre-World War One into World War One. The United States was not terribly concerned with adding air power to that. However, the British were definitely interested, and they began to innovate in this space early on. They began to experiment with Navy ships. First, they were using essentially a version of water landing planes, like seaplanes. Mm-hmm. But those are very slow. Landing and taking off is slow, and getting them aboard a ship required the use of cranes. Mm-hmm. So it was not a good process if you were under the possibility of being under fire from an enemy.
Yeah, you have to act quick.
Exactly. So they started looking into other possibilities, and it was the British Navy in 1918 that commissioned the first true practical aircraft carrier. It was the HMS Argus.
Interesting.
And so the Argus is our first practical aircraft carrier. It had a large flat deck, which became standard for all aircraft carriers following ever since. And that allowed for the landing and taking off of aircraft. It was also the first that had an electrically powered elevator to move aircraft from the hangar deck to the flight deck.
Very smart. And that's something we still see today.
Yes. And that means that you can actually carry a lot more vehicles. Plus, you don't have to worry. Like if really bad weather's coming in, you can house them in the hangar deck as opposed to having them have to secure them to the flight deck, mm-hmm. Which could be pretty dangerous to put, you know, these are huge vehicles. So that lays the groundwork for the beginning of aircraft carrier history. But we're going to skip ahead to how they work today. And then later on, I'll tell you more about the various classes of aircraft carriers that the United States specifically has used over the history of the Navy.
Can I maybe just say one thing here?
And sure.
Maybe I'm jumping too far ahead here, but during World War One, their use was extremely limited. They really didn't even put any kind of emphasis on it at all. It really wasn't part of World War One strategy in any way.
Yeah.
But during World War Two, they played a critical role.
Instrumental.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Extremely critical I found this interesting. There was a side note about one of the battles, mm-hmm. That was fought during World War II. And it said that the Battle of the Coral Sea.
Yes.
Became the first sea battle in history in which neither opposing fleet saw the other one.
Right.
That is so interesting. I mean, imagine this. There's a sea battle happening where you don't see the other ship.
Right.
Because the battle's being fought by the planes in the air that they're launching towards each other. I mean, it's such a strange thought that before that had never happened.
Exactly. You had planes that were dropping bombs. They were dropping torpedoes. So the planes were the weapons, right?
Yes.
Instead of ships firing guns at one another, they're essentially launching planes at one another.
And they're
so far apart, they cannot see each other.
And this is so interesting because, I mean, if you think about it, you have to put yourself in the mind frame, you know, that they were back in the 1940s. Mm-hmm. This is brand new because if you wanted to get a plane over a sea battle, first, you probably wouldn't know where it's happening.
Right.
And you wouldn't be able to communicate that and get that coordinated in time before something has already happened.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that the range was just too great for them because fighter planes are often, you know, weighted down with lots of artillery.
Sure.
And they don't have great range. They have a shorter range than a plane that's designed to fly long distances that don't carry a bunch of, you know, extra weapons, bombs,
sure.
You know, guns, whatever. So this is a brand new idea that we're going to take the planes to the battle and, you know, launch them from there instead of having to kind of, you know, keep them far, far away. And then maybe they'll make it. Maybe they won't.
Right.
If they decide that they can't, you know, hold out long enough to get there, they'll have to turn back. It was a completely different way of thinking. And it's just such a fascinating time in history. When you look back at some of the side notes of mm-hmm. all these battles and the way that they were fought, it's just completely different from World War One. Completely different.
Well, really, what had happened was, even during the World War One era, the navies around the world looked at aircraft carriers again as a means of carrying reconnaissance vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Planes were not terribly useful in warfare yet at that point. They were very useful for finding out where the enemy fleets were so that you could direct your fleets and do the most damage possible. And what really changed was that, you would think of like an aircraft carrier was an escort to a battleship, and the battleships were your big boys. Those were the ones that actually did the damage until the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
Now, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, the ships that were docked at Pearl Harbor were battleships, but the aircraft carriers were out on maneuvers. Mm-hmm. So the Japanese attack affected the battleships, but not the aircraft carriers, which meant that the United States was forced to reevaluate their strategies, and they were forced to use aircraft carriers as weapons as opposed to a means of just reconnaissance. And that's what led to these things like the Battle of the Coral Sea, where we end up getting this effect of aircraft carriers being used effectively as weapons of war.
Well, also, and I think this goes without saying, that the Japanese fleet was launched from an aircraft carrier as
yes.
well. So the squadrons that attacked Pearl Harbor came from an aircraft carrier
right.
that was, several miles off,
mm-hmm.
But, stealthily moved in and then was able to retreat back to the homeland.
Right. It was incredibly effective. It was a devastating attack, as we all know.
Yeah.
And so this was really what ended up changing the way wars were fought for several decades. And so it was something that proved the aircraft carrier's importance as a vehicle in an arsenal, right?
As you just mentioned, it was that the aircraft carrier was the support vehicle or the add-on vehicle,
yeah.
the chaperone, I guess, that
sure.
would go along, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
then the roles reversed.
Exactly.
I mean, then it became that, the destroyers and the cruisers and all those were tagging along with the aircraft carrier because that was the big guns.
Right. Yeah, you had those there to protect the aircraft carrier because the aircraft carrier had all the really valuable aircraft on it that could do devastating damage very, very quickly. So it was interesting to see such a dramatic shift. And it was a dramatic shift that, by the way, did not happen smoothly. It took the work of lots of people in the Navy to convince other branches of the military that this, in fact, was the best way of going forward.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk a little bit about some of the interesting battles in the United States that had nothing to do with using weapons or fighting an enemy. It was really the battles being fought between different branches of the military,
mm-hmm.
particularly the Air Force and the Navy. There's a story about the aircraft carrier that wasn't. It was one that was almost, but then wasn't. But
yes.
Let's talk a little bit about how these massive, and I really do mean massive, machines work.
Yeah, now you have seen one in person.
I have. I've been aboard the Midway.
Okay, I've seen one in person. I've never been on one.
Yeah. You got to pack a lunch if you're going to walk from one side to the other. They are big.
They are huge. I mean, we're talking like, I'm just going to ballpark these numbers. Okay?
Sure.
We're talking like more than 1,000 feet long.
Yep.
The deck is measured in acres, something like
yeah.
four and a half acres. They are like, it's like taking a building. I think I read somewhere that it was like, imagine the, which building is it in New York? The Chrysler building
yep.
in New York. Tilt the Chrysler building on its side, put mm-hmm. it in water.
Yeah.
And that's the length of the build of the ship.
Right.
But then even greater than that, it's like it's 20 stories tall.
Yeah.
When it's floating.
Yeah. Yeah. If you go from the keel of the ship, the keel is the backbone of mm-hmm. the ship, the part that's, at the very bottom center, all the way to the very top, you're talking like the equivalent of 24 stories.
Amazing.
I mean, it's a huge, huge machine with yeah. thousands of parts to
yeah.
it.
Yeah, a billion parts or something like
yeah.
that is what I read somewhere. I don't know if that's true or not, but I mean, they literally said it's a billion parts on these ships. And it's truly like running a city.
Yes.
Because there are thousands of crew members. We'll talk about numbers when we get to it here, but yeah, there are thousands of people on board, and they have to do everything, from collecting the garbage to making sure that, people are fed.
Right.
And, of course, fighting a war, maybe.
Sure, sure.
Potentially. Running just, doing regular missions, I guess. If they're just stationed off the coast of, whatever country,
mm-hmm.
they just have to make sure that everything is operating smoothly.
Yep.
There's just every concern that you would have with a small city
mm-hmm.
is happening on that ship, and there has to be somebody to take care of it.
A small city that relies on nuclear power.
Ah,
because
yes.
that makes it even more complicated. So
yes.
all modern supercarriers use nuclear power to generate steam.
Yeah.
The ones that we talk about today have two nuclear power plants on them. that's actually different from previous ones. Earlier supercarriers had more nuclear power plants, not fewer, but more, because they had a bunch of smaller ones. But
there were as many as 8.
Yes. With like 4 different shafts that steam would go through to turn propellers.
Incredible.
So you generate steam. I mean, really, if you talk about old aircraft carriers, you're still talking steam. But in those days, you're talking about a boiler that's being heated through using fossil fuels.
Sure.
Today, we're talking about using nuclear power to heat up water to turn it to steam. It turns steam turbines, which do two main things. It generates the energy needed to turn the massive propellers. We're talking like more than 20 feet in diameter, mm-hmm. right? These are huge propellers that propel the ship through the water, and they are used to generate electricity aboard the ship.
I've got a little bit more info on that if you'd like.
Sure.
We can talk about it. But
yeah, let's do it.
I just want to just kind of throw some stuff in here, and you're going to hear a bunch of note shuffling because I got notes everywhere.
Yeah, and I do too, actually. This is a first for me because usually I have my computer in here, but I actually am using this stuff called paper.
You're going low tech like
me. Yeah, it's kind of crazy.
I do it all the time. Low tech. All right, so the USS Enterprise was built in 1958, well, actually built between 1958 and 1961. This is a big ship.
Now, this is an Enterprise class ship, because there was a previous ship that was also known as the USS Enterprise. And by the way, neither of these were the ones that carried Kirk and Spock.
Good point. I'm really glad you pointed that out.
Yeah. Although I think they did visit it in Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home.
Maybe
they went because they said, Captain, we found the vessel and it's the Enterprise. Anyway.
Okay. I'm amused by this. All right.
So,
it was in service between 1962 and 2012. So it was only recently decommissioned. Mm-hmm. This was the very first nuclear powered aircraft carrier. Mm-hmm. And it had 8 what they called A2W reactors. Now, the A2W, I was wondering what the heck that stood for. So mm-hmm. I looked it up. It's pretty simple, actually. A is just aircraft carrier. 2 stands for the second generation, designed by that particular designer, I guess, that contractor. Mm-hmm. And W stands for Westinghouse, and that was the contractor. So A2W, so that's the second generation Westinghouse aircraft carrier power source.
Yeah.
All right. And this is the first nuclear-powered, I'm going to say nuclear.
Yes. Not nuclear.
Nuclear, I might say it, but, you know, get ready for that. But it actually, provided power for 4 propulsion plants. So mm-hmm. each propulsion plant had 2 reactors that were tied to it. Mm-hmm. And okay, according to the way that it's all laid out, I guess, they each powered 2 different shafts. So let's say there's the 1A shaft, the 1B shaft, the 2A shaft, the 2B shaft. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the way it worked, right? Mm-hmm. All right. And I'll try to walk through this carefully here so we don't miss too much. I know it's going to be a simplified version. But each one of these was capable of running on just 1 reactor if it had to, but 2 were required for full power. So if they're going to steam ahead at, what is it, top speed, like 30 knots maybe?
Yeah, which is about 34.5 miles per hour. Actually, the Navy has been very careful to never divulge the specifics. There were some sources I saw where they said it could move in excess of 40 knots, which is incredible speed. At that speed, you can water ski behind the aircraft carrier without skis. You could barefoot water ski behind it.
I would like to try that.
Yeah, that would be kind of exciting.
Yeah. All right. So you could run on 1, you know, 1 reactor per shaft, but they said it was, you know, 2 were required for full power and, you know, for plane launching capability, which we'll talk about why that's important in a little while. Now again, the simplified version of how these reactors work, if you want to get into it or not, I don't know. Mm-hmm. They're actually fueled by enriched uranium-235.
Yep.
And all this is foreign to me. I'm speaking another language. So bear with me, but they use, something called hafnium control rods in the reactor, and that's how they control just how much steam they're creating.
Sure.
They're able to submerse or pull them out to a level that reaches what they call the criticality point.
Yep.
And I hope I'm saying that right.
Yes.
But that's the point which nuclear fission reactors reach a place where they're self-sustaining.
Yes.
They create their own energy, their own power.
What's happening is that when one of those atoms decays, it generates some very high energy particles, which when they collide with other atoms cause them to decay, and then you get a self-sustaining reaction, which, by the way, if you aren't able to contain, becomes a meltdown.
Sure.
So anytime we're talking nuclear power with fission, it's a very scientific approach, a delicate balance to make sure that you have the balance between generating the heat you need so that you can create the steam you need to turn a turbine and preventing it from getting out of control.
Ah, yes. And that's part of, you know, why they have these cool down towers and all that, right? So they're water cooled, and that's where the steam is created.
Yep.
Because of the cooling water that they use for these things. So, the steam or and this is again, very, very simplified because there's a lot of processes that happen here, but the steam is sent to the main engine area, you know, for the electrical generators, the aircraft catapult system, and lots of other, auxiliary features that they mention here in this article. So runs just about actually it does run everything on board. So anything, I mean, you flip a light switch, that's being run by, well, steam power, but
from a nuclear
reactor.
Source, yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing. So the turbines, which are double ended, are then caused to spin at a high rate of speed from the steam. And the main shaft, which is, you know, spinning with the turbine, you know, at a very, very high rate of speed, it goes through a reduction gear, which kind of steps down the power to a point where they're able to use it even to propel the ship because those propellers are giant. They're like 21 feet across and there's four of them.
Right.
Huge, huge screws on these things. And, for them to even be able to use that power, there's so much power there that they have to reduce the power in order to be able to propel the ship forward.
Right. I could imagine, like, what's really important there, at least initially, is the torque. So you gotta create the torque necessary to get those things moving.
I would think it's important, yes.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break to thank our sponsor.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Classes in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So why go with nuclear power in the first place? Well, the big reason is that you don't need to refuel for many, many years.
Yes, no range anxiety. That's what I was. I wrote that down here in this in this note. When I wrote that self-sustaining part, I wrote down no range anxiety. That's amazing. So they can go out and they can spend a year out at sea if they want to.
Yeah.
Or 2 years or 3 years or whatever.
And you know, they're able to. Now, obviously, food would be something that they would need supplies for. Water, not so much, because they have desalination plants. They can actually convert seawater into drinkable water.
Incredible.
But it does mean that they don't have to refuel nearly as frequently. When they do refuel, that's a multi-year process because nuclear fuel is no joke. But they can go decades before needing to refuel.
Is that amazing?
It is amazing.
I'm going to say that over and over again. You're going to be saying something. I'm just going to say that's incredible. That's amazing.
And another thing that makes this really interesting is not from the technological point of view, but from the political point of view. Aircraft carriers are considered sovereign territory. So as long as that sovereign territory does not venture too close to, say, a country's borders within it, you know, that extend out from the coast out a certain number of miles into the ocean, as long as the aircraft carrier is outside of that, it is technically a part of whatever nation owns that aircraft carrier. So in the United States sense, you are on U.S. quote-unquote soil while you're on an aircraft carrier, even if that aircraft carrier is parked way out in, you know, in the Middle East or in Asia or wherever, you are still on U.S. soil.
I like that idea.
Yeah, so it really is like a floating city. You know, as the city itself can actually relocate. So let's talk a little bit about some of the different parts of this. We mentioned that the top deck is the flight deck.
Yeah.
That is, of course, where all the planes take off and land. In the old days, we're talking propeller planes. These days, we're talking jets. The design of aircraft carriers has had to change dramatically along with the evolution of aircraft. And we'll talk more about that when I get into the different classes of aircraft carriers. One of the things that you mentioned, Scott, was the steam-powered catapult. And you guys might be wondering, what is that? What do you mean by catapult? Is there like a medieval catapult that you put the plane in and it launches it? Not quite.
No. Well, the idea is that, you know, with the advent of jet aircraft and the idea that you want to put them on a boat and launch them, that requires a lot of airflow over the surface of the wing.
Yep.
In order for it to get enough lift to be able to get off the ship.
Right. And they have a truncated takeoff strip, right? Because they're limited by the length of the vessel, and it's not even the full length of the vessel.
No.
It's part of it. So
no, it's like 300 feet basically.
Yeah. So there are two things that aircraft carriers do to improve the ability of jets to take off. One is they turn into the wind. And they go as fast as they can into the wind, which generates more airflow.
That is so smart.
Right. You don't want to go away because then that reduces airflow. So they turn into the wind and they go as fast as they can to generate airflow. And then they have to find a way to have these jets accelerate rapidly so that they can get to a speed where they can take off. And that's where this steam catapult comes in.
Yeah, and it looks like a slot on the deck of the ship.
I mean,
that's all it looks like, really. And if you've, you know what, I'll be honest with you. I think this matches up with a lot of the way that they're launching some current roller coasters now.
Oh, yeah, theme parks.
You've seen this, right?
Yeah.
There's one in Cedar Point in Michigan, in Ohio.
Yeah.
And it's called Top Fuel Dragster, I think. And you sit on the launch pad and
I've ridden this roller coaster.
You have?
Yeah,
oh, no kidding.
Twice.
So it's the same idea.
You
can probably describe it. I mean, it's steam pressure that builds, and I don't know if it's steam in that case,
right,
but it builds up pressure in the cylinder and you're holding it back. You're resisting that.
Yeah, you're allowing that pressure to continue to build. There's a piston that's at the end of the cylinder.
Yeah.
And behind that piston is where you're building up this incredible amount of pressure.
Yes.
Now keep in mind the steam is coming from the nuclear power generator. That's what's creating the heat that's creating the steam. So there's plenty of it. There's no shortage of steam here. And you just build and build the pressure until you've reached the right amount, which by the way is determined by a flight controller, and it's based upon the type of aircraft that needs to launch and the current deck conditions.
Again, very smart, because they found out that, you know, certain planes require more force to be able to launch at a certain speed, and if you don't do it hard enough, it's going to go right off into the ocean, and that's bad news for everybody.
Exactly. So the aircraft have what's called a tow bar, which connects into the shuttle. The shuttle is the element on the aircraft carrier that actually moves through the steam catapult that accelerates at this incredible rate. The pistons, there's actually a pair of them. So there's a cylinder on either side that connect to this shuttle. The tow bar hooks in, and the tow bar is connected to the nose of the aircraft.
Yeah, the wheels up front. And there's also something called a holdback,
yes,
which they fasten between the back of the wheel and the shuttle. And the holdback is, it does just what it says it does.
It holds back the jet because one of the other things you have to do is turn on those jet engines.
Yeah, this is interesting because they do raise something, a big platform behind it that raises up behind the airplane. You can picture this. It's almost like a wall that stands up behind the plane. And what that does is it's just a jet blast deflector. In fact, that's what they call it. And that just doesn't allow, you know, someone to get blown overboard, you know, behind them when, you know, you go full throttle on an F-18 or whatever.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so that launches up. And just before launch, I mean, they're checking everything. They're getting all the signals for the go and everything. And the pilot has to go full throttle while he's still attached to the shuttle via the tow bar.
Right.
And the whole back is still in place.
Right.
But he's going full throttle and then they finally give the the go, I guess, for the shuttle to launch. And that's what catapults the aircraft off the end of the plane.
Yeah.
Off the end of the deck.
Yeah. Essentially you say, release the so that the pressure can push the pistons forward, so the plane is being towed, that's why you call it the tow bar, by the shuttle at an incredible speed. When it gets to the end, it can then take off and fly off into the great blue yonder,
hopefully.
If everything has gone well. And this was the shuttle technology, again, was pioneered by the British.
And you know what? Just to give you an idea of how strong this is, and we'll get back to the British in just a second, but this is a really strong system. And we were talking about steam, and you might think it's not all that forceful, but or maybe you do. I don't know. But it takes a 45,000-pound plane from 0 to 165 miles per hour in 2 seconds.
Yeah, that's faster than a Tesla.
2 seconds. Yeah, that's considerably faster than that. But it's not quite as fast as a top fuel dragster.
Which is pretty, by the way, it's an intense roller coaster. Two times I rode that. Yeah.
Oh, I wasn't even thinking of that. I was thinking of the real deal, the real car.
Yeah.
And I've heard, you know, I've talked to guys that drive those top fuel dragsters, the kind that look like long rails, you know, the real, the 30-foot long ones or whatever the length is. They said it feels like you're sitting in a stoplight and a semi hits you from behind at about 200 miles an hour. That's what it feels like when those things launch. So that's got to be exactly what the pilots feel when they launch off of a deck of an aircraft carrier. It's even more exhilarating than a standard, if you can call it that, a standard runway takeoff, because they have so much greater distance and a much greater amount of time to be able to get up to speed.
Right, right.
Greater margin of error, I suppose.
Speaking of margin of error, something that you have very low margin of error is landing on an aircraft carrier.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That's another really interesting aspect of this whole thing is that, you know, and it took them a couple of months to figure out initially, remember? We said they were thinking about it, but it's become even more complex with jets.
Yeah. So the idea of the main method that is used to stop aircraft, to help aircraft come to a stop when they land on an aircraft carrier, dates back to the propeller plane days, but it has become increasingly important in the jet world, as you were pointing out, Scott. And it's using a tail hook. And a tail hook is just what it sounds like. You have the tail of your aircraft. There is a hook that descends down that can hook on to something. In this case, we're talking about arresting wires.
Yeah.
These are very thick cables that stretch across the width of the landing area of the flight deck.
Mm-hmm.
And your goal as a pilot is to hit a specific arresting cable. There in older ships, there are a series of four. In more modern ones, there are only three. So with the older ships, you were told to hit the third one.
Now, isn't this strange? Now, this is the first time that I'd ever heard this. When I was reading this article, this is the How Stuff Works article that we're looking at here. The goal is to hit the third wire in the set, and that's the safest, most effective wire to hit. Now, I was thinking, why is it any worse than... Now, I can understand maybe not wanting to hit the first one because it's too close to the edge.
Right.
I get that. And the last one is kind of a, you better hit it or else you're going over the edge.
Right.
But why not the second or the third? I guess the third just shows some kind of precision.
Yeah. Well, and if you were able to consistently hit that third one, it would show that you were a particularly skilled pilot, and thus you would rise up the ranks more quickly, because you were showing that you had the precision, the skill, and the concern necessary to continue in this. If you were not consistently hitting it, you might not be flying that much longer.
Yeah, I think that's what it's all about, though. I think it's all about, you know, just being able to have Navy bragging rights. Yeah. You can hit the third wire every single time. What do you think?
Maybe. In the more current ones, the more modern ones where there's only three wires, you're supposed to hit the second one.
Oh.
So, again, you're aiming for the one, the middle one, not the one on either end. What these wires do is they're actually connected to giant hydraulic systems. And so when the aircraft hooks one of the wires, it obviously starts to pull on that wire. The hydraulics act as sort of a braking mechanism. Now, when you watch one of these aircraft land, it looks like it stops almost immediately. What's actually happening is that it's not just a taut wire that's attached to, like, anchored down to stationary points, because that would very likely cause damage to the aircraft or to the aircraft carrier or both, and it could...
The person inside.
The person, yeah, the human beings.
It's tough to stop immediately.
Yeah, and there's lots of footage... tragic footage of aircraft that were unable to stop, including ones where they had not yet started using arresting wires.
Yeah.
And you see, I saw one where it not only did it skid continuously down the landing strip, it collided with aircraft that were further down the aircraft carrier.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're talking about prop planes.
Yeah, super dangerous stuff. In fact, sure. There's an article I read called Several Reasons Why Aircraft Carriers Are Super Dangerous by Sam Lagrone, who worked in the Naval Institute. And he talked about how precise you had to be, how closely these things could come between, you know, success and failure. And it's pretty terrifying. It actually mentions that that if you were flying some of the larger aircraft like the Navy's E-2 Hawkeye, let's say that you don't hit that third cable and you don't hit the fourth cable, what you have to do then is you have to throttle up full speed so that you can fly up and then come back around and try again.
Can I tell you something? I think that even if you hit that third wire or you hit the second wire or the first wire, I think you still go full throttle.
Yeah.
Which is so weird because you would think that, okay, it's snagged, it's secure, but they don't know that yet. They don't know if it's going to skip over it, if it's got a tenuous grasp on it that, you know, it's going to let go. So they're trained that when that contact is made, even though you feel it grab, you still go full throttle just for a brief second.
Yeah.
Just in case, because that's your last chance. Otherwise, if you're going over the edge slow, you better hit the ejector because that's your only way out.
Yeah, because otherwise you're going into the drain.
Yeah, and it always ends up upside down.
Yeah. So, the standard procedure is that you need to take off again. It's called, you have to be a bolter. You have to bolt.
A bolter.
Yeah, they call them bolters where you end up having to take back off again. Well, here's the thing. Depending on the size of the aircraft, you might not have a very large margin of error. For example, the Navy's E-2 Hawkeye, the width margin of error can be a foot.
No way.
12 inches of whether, like, you have that 12 inches of space to throttle up before you are not going to be fast enough to get take off again.
That's incredible.
And
say it again.
Yeah. 12 in, well, I mean, it is incredible. You think about the amazing skill and courage it takes to handle this kind of aircraft. Another interesting thing is that there was a development that made this easier. Early aircraft, imagine that you've got a 2x4, all right? And then you've got a ruler that's not as wide as your 2x4. And you lay the ruler down, and the ruler represents the landing strip on your aircraft carrier. And the 2x4 itself is just barely longer than the ruler.
Okay.
And so those were the early aircraft carriers, right? You had just kind of a straight strip that was where you would land and take off. And it'll also be where you would be mustering your aircraft, which means that there were a lot of potential places where you could have collisions if things did not go well.
Yeah.
The British came up with a brilliant way of getting around this. They decided to tilt the landing strip by 14 degrees so that it was not it didn't go the length of the ship. And by tilt, I don't mean that it was tilted on, like it wasn't like a canted surface.
Not uphill or downhill or left, right.
No, it was just instead of it being a straight road, imagine that you just turn that.
So it's off the keel. It's off the line of the keel.
Exactly. So that meant that you could have a mustering area for aircraft that was not directly in the path of where aircraft were landing. The British were the ones who came up with that. The British were the ones who came up with the arresting wires. And then the United States and other nations said, this is a really good idea that we are going to also employ.
Very clever.
Yeah. Yeah. Ways of making something that is, no matter how you slice it, incredibly dangerous, less so.
You know, there are some that even have I think they call it a ski jump at the end. It looks like a ramp. It ramps up at the end so that you get just that little bit more of a lift at the end, I suppose. Puts you in the right direction.
I would imagine so. Yeah. Yeah. And I've also seen ones like, you know, they had other methods of trying to capture aircraft that might not have hit the arresting wires just right, including things like giant nets that would help slow down aircraft, which sometimes worked and sometimes didn't.
Yeah, it seems like that would bring its own problems.
Yeah, to illustrate how dangerous this is, again, going back to that several reasons article I mentioned, Legrone quotes a statistic that really is eye-opening. Between 1948 and 1988, the number of U.S. sailors and Marines that died in and around aircraft carriers was 8,500.
Wow.
In 40 years, 8,500 people dying. Now, that includes combat, but that actually makes a much smaller number than accidents.
No kidding.
Yeah.
So, okay, I can mention a couple of accidents if you want me to talk about them.
Yeah.
All right. So during the 1960s, there was kind of a bleak time for the U.S. Navy.
Mm-hmm.
They suffered 3 fires aboard aircraft carriers in the 1960s. And these, what's interesting about this is you can go back and look at these. You can look at photographs because they were, you know, filmed in a lot of cases. And they use these disasters as training films for current military members on aircraft, what not to do and what to do, because they got a little better at it here. But, going back to, and I'll just list these kind of quickly, but Just off the coast of Vietnam in 1966, on October 26th, the USS Oriskany, CVA-34, if you're interested in that designation, the hull designation, there were a couple of guys that were loading some flares into a locker below deck, and one of the flares went off, and there were 650 other flares in the locker they were loading. And the guy, I don't know if he panicked or what, but when the flare went off, he shut the door real quick. He didn't try to grab that one flare out. And the result was a, I think it was like a huge fire that killed something like 44 men, 44 crew members on board. So that was, and there was extensive damage to the ship. And then just a year later in July of 1967, again, off the coast of Vietnam, the USS Forrestal.
This is a famous one.
Yeah, this is. Now, this was an accidental rocket deployment that slammed into a parked A-4 that was on the deck, and then that spread to other aircraft on the deck. And, you know, of course, bombs began to explode all over the place on top of that. You can imagine what's going on. This is a 13-hour fire that that killed 134 crew members. That was a huge fire. There were 21 aircraft destroyed during this one. And this one is the one that I think they use as the training film of what can go wrong. And then in 1969, to kind of round out the decade with another disaster here, the USS Enterprise, the, you know, the first nuclear-powered carrier, had a had a terrible fire as well, similar to the Forrestal fire. But this was a rocket that ignited and hit another aircraft, and, you know, due to exhaust heat, I think is what set this one off. But it took 4 hours to extinguish that one, and 28 crew members were killed during that, and 15 aircraft were destroyed. So they had their fair share of you know, hard knocks in 1960, in the 1960s, throughout the whole decade. And I know that, you know, safety has improved over the decades, but there's probably still a lot of small things that happen on board, apparently. I mean, if 8,000 people have died on these. These are dangerous places to be.
I mean, I mean, well, even if, like, there can be things that have nothing to do with the flight deck or the hangar or the aircraft or any of the weaponry even. I mean, you're just talking about a confined environment where you have several thousand people existing. There are plenty of opportunities for accidents that, you know, they're the same sort of accidents that you could encounter in any other environment. So the figures that I mentioned, you know, not all of those were necessarily the result of some sort of catastrophic accident like the ones we've been talking about, but it does illustrate that this is an environment that, that is by its very nature dangerous.
I mean, you could fall and bump your head. You could choke on something in the
mess hall.
And I mean, stuff like that, or you'd fall overboard.
A friend of mine served in the Navy. He didn't serve aboard an aircraft carrier, but one of the descriptions he gave me, I imagine there were probably lots of bumps and bruises whenever seas got particularly rough. Because he talked about how if you're going above or below whatever deck you're on in a ship, we call them decks. They're not floors. So if you're on a deck and you need to go up or down, you climb what is almost a ladder. They are sets of stairs technically, but they are so steep that it's practically a ladder.
Yeah, because space is at a premium.
Exactly. And if the seas are really, really rough, the world around you is moving. And he talked about how, there were times where he would start to climb, and because of the way the ship would roll, he would end up being at the top of the stairs way faster than he had anticipated.
Wow.
Like, he would take a step, and then the ship would roll as he was stepping, and it's kind of like when you would jump on a trampoline just right.
Yeah, you feel a little bit weightless.
Yeah, you suddenly end up much higher up than you expected. Yeah, it could be actually terrifying. I have one really cool story of an accident that was averted by someone who was in a different accident that was, that thankfully tragedy was also averted. This guy just had the best luck. Captain Jim Lovell. This, if the name sounds familiar, it's probably because you've watched Apollo 13.
Yeah.
He was the commander of the Apollo 13 space mission. He also, in 1954, was flying a mission in a McDonnell F-2H Banshee night fighter.
And sounds like a cool jet.
Cool jet, but he had an issue in that there was an electrical failure on his plane, and all his instruments went dead. And it's at night, and he has to find the aircraft carrier.
Oh, boy.
by vision. Like, you have to find it. Like, you know, he didn't have any electronics to tell him where anything was because of the electrical failure. So he had to find the carrier, the USS Shangri-La. And the way he found it was he saw a luminescent trail from luminescent algae that was left in the wake of the carrier and followed it to the carrier that he could land successfully.
That is so smart. What that guy hasn't lived through, huh? Or hadn't lived through at that point.
I mean, that's pretty crazy.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think we've really driven it home, but yeah, dangerous location, right? One of the things that we haven't talked about yet, it's also on the flight deck, is the island.
Yeah. Yeah. This is important. This is where the, I guess all the radar capabilities and the
satellite.
Yeah, the crew, the commanders are walking around up there, telling people what to do.
So this is like the tower structure that you would see on the top of an aircraft carrier. It's the command center, and it's the command center for the flight deck as well as the general ship, right? And it has lots of different decks to it. As well, it is about 150 feet tall. That's about 46 meters, but only about 20 feet wide or 6 meters wide at the base of the island. That's also because you don't want to take up too much space on the flight deck. You want to have as much of that space available as possible.
Sure.
And this is where you have lots of different decks that have important elements to it. So at the very top, you've got that array of satellite dishes, radar dishes, that kind of stuff.
Sure.
Below that is the primary flight control, or PryFly.
Yep.
The Navy has lots of fun names for everything.
PryFly.
Like, you know, when we mentioned about the arresting wires and landing in them.
Yes.
I watched a documentary where the guy said, yeah, they call that landing in the spaghetti. when you're landing in the cables, you're landing in the spaghetti.
It's a good term. Makes sense, right? I mean, it really does. So,
it always makes me wonder if he's just, if they're just yanking our chains at that point, like, what can we tell them
that we call this? And they're like, they're going to start using that.
Yeah, they're going to call it landing in the spaghetti.
All right, so below the pry fly, if that's what they call it, is the bridge, and that's the ship's command center.
Yes, the bridge. Now, this is where I am in my familiar element, because I love ships. I love ships. And the bridge is that command center where the captain oversees the control of the ship. Now, keep in mind that aircraft carriers typically are part of a larger group of ships. They aren't traveling on their own. They have escort ships. So that you have, generally speaking, several in your group. Now, a captain only commands one ship. Mm-hmm. That is, the captain's responsibility is to that ship and that ship alone. So the captain is on the bridge that's where you have your helmsman, who is controlling the steering of the vehicle, the aircraft carrier. You have another one, the lee helmsman, who sends commands down to engineering for the speed. So, you know, Mr. Scott down in engineering can give it or more powder, Captain.
Sure.
That was the worst Scottish accent I've ever tried. You have also the quartermaster of the watch, who is keeping track of the navigation information. Below that, you have a deck where you have the flag bridge. That's where the admiral is.
Yep.
Now, the admiral is in charge of all the vessels in that group, not just the aircraft carrier. So the captain commands the aircraft carrier. The admiral has the job of administering for the entire group of ships.
Yeah. And then below the flag bridge is just various operational centers.
Yes.
I mean, these are where they monitor the deck control and launch operations and stuff like that. I mean,
I love, again, some of the names, like the aircraft handling officer, sometimes called the handler or mangler.
That's a big difference between the handler and the mangler, if you ask me.
My favorite description in this How Stuff Works article, which, by the way, is fantastic. I highly recommend, if you're interested in this, to go to How Stuff Works and look up how aircraft carriers work. Mm-hmm. My favorite description is how the aircraft handler, their job is to track which aircraft are on the flight deck, which ones are in the hangar, which ones are out, you know, have flown off. And they do so using something called the Ouija board.
Oh, yes. This is like a cool toy.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is really neat.
Yeah, it's a transparent table that has outlines of the flight deck and the hangar deck and little cutouts that represent each aircraft, and they're to scale. So the bigger aircraft have bigger cutouts than the smaller aircraft.
Well, they have to, otherwise they wouldn't know how many would fit and where they would
exactly.
fit. It's all to scale, so they know exactly how to place everything and exactly where it fits. So, I like this. I like this. I like it when things are measured and organized like this. I enjoy this. I like this procedure.
It looks like, it sounds to me like it's the super coolest version of Risk.
Yeah, it does.
Because, you know, you're moving, all right, I need to move these aircraft from my hangar to the flight deck, and then I move these little models from this part of the etching to that part of the etching to represent that.
And not only that, you look out the window and it happens.
Yeah.
In real life.
Yeah.
To a real plane on a real ship.
It's the best game of Risk ever, right? Then you also have the combat direction center. Obviously, that would be very important whenever the ship is actively involved in combat. You've got the galley deck. That's immediately below the flight deck. You've got the hangar deck, which is lower down. That's where all the aircraft are. It's actually several decks tall. It's called the hangar deck, but it's actually multiple decks tall because you have to accommodate those aircraft.
By the way, do yourself a favor and get on Google Images and look at a hangar deck at some point. It's amazing. It really is. It's so cool the way they position all the planes. I mean, they're all put in there exactly in precisely the right way. And this is where they move them in and out on the elevators, you know, the lift systems to get them up to the flight deck. Mm-hmm. It's a neat space. It's almost like, it's like several warehouses is what it looks like.
Yeah.
Linked together, and then they store this incredible arsenal of planes in there.
Yeah, some of these can have like 80 or more aircraft aboard them.
Yeah, how do you figure out how to move around 80 aircraft without bumping into each other all the time?
And they even have doors that can close between different chambers. Obviously, that is a safety precaution. Let's say that the aircraft carrier has entered combat. You want to be able to close off one part of the hangar bay from the others if there were an enemy attack that pierced part of it, because you want to control the spread of fire.
Sure.
So you might be able to close one of those doors and save 3/4 of your aircraft in the case of catastrophe. Or, you know, even if it were just an accident and not an act of combat, you would want that ability.
And then at the back end of that, of the hangar area, is an open section at the very aft end of the ship, very back end, that they can open up a door.
Yep.
And they can test jet engines off the back of the boat. How cool would that be?
Only safe place to do it, because it's open to the air.
Mm-hmm.
That's just aft of the aircraft intermediate maintenance division, or AIMD shops. Mm-hmm. That's where they would do the basic maintenance that would be needed to make sure the aircraft remain in, you know, flyable condition.
Mm-hmm.
And again, all of this is necessary just for the basic function of the aircraft carrier as its purpose as a military vehicle. Then on top of that, you have all the mess halls, the galleys, the sleeping arrangements, which are cozy at best.
I would bet.
So Scott.
Yeah.
Okay. You're still here. Good.
I'm still here.
All right. Good. Turns out we had a lot more to say about aircraft carriers than what I might have originally anticipated. And therefore, we have decided to split the epic episode into two slightly less epic episodes.
I think that's a good plan.
Yeah, because honestly, you guys can't handle an hour and 40-minute long podcast.
No. And looking at my notes here, there's a lot more to cover. I mean, we haven't even talked about the classes of ships.
Yeah. Yet. So let's get we'll make the second episode the classy episode. This is the classless episode. The next one's the classy episode.
Oh boy.
Guys, if you really want to experience class, you need to go check out Car Stuff.
Oh, shucks.
Classy podcast.
Thank you.
Especially with your classic cars. You and Ben have covered some really cool topics in Car Stuff. And you've got some amazing videos, too. So you guys got to check that out. If you've ever wanted to get an up-close look at exotic cars, you guys do a good job of getting right up in there.
Oh, thank you. You're too kind.
Yeah, so check that stuff out, guys. If you have any suggestions for me, you have a request for a particular topic, send me a message. That email address is techstuff@howstuffworks.com, or drop me a line on Facebook, Twitter, or Tumblr. The handle on all three is techstuff, HSW. We'll talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Hello there. I'm Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for IndieWire.
And I'm IndieWire's deputy film editor, Ryan Latanzio.
And we're the co-hosts of IndieWire's weekly Screen Talk podcast.
Join us each week for an in-depth discussion of the latest in film and TV industry news with special guests along the way, including filmmakers and executives.
Hear from us every Friday morning on iHeart platforms or wherever you get your podcasts as IndieWire shares what we've learned from the movie week that was.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.